This is Janice Radway, and we're both going to talk this morning about romance and sexuality. I'm going to begin by talking about literature and popular culture for girls, and then Janice is going to talk about romantic novels for women and some of the issues in relation to intervention and ideology. We're hopefully both going to talk for about half an hour each, and then we'll open it up for a general discussion. Okay? I've brought along with me some, I hope, when we get to some aspects of popular fiction for girls in Britain. Okay, well, the question that I began to ask myself in relation to today's session is, how does popular literature for girls relate to romantic novels of the kind read by women that Janice has done work on? And it's my contention that, at least in the literature I've looked at in Britain, that although the content of some of the popular fictions for girls isn't overtly sexual in any way, it actually plays on very deep and important themes which prepare girls for the romantic resolution, the arrival of the prince, the romantic novels in the future. That is, popular fiction plays on themes which relate to desperate losses and their resolution, especially for working class girls for whom the misery of their deprivation is related to their removal from harsh, cruel circumstances and families, and the resolution of the insertion of the girl into wealthy families and a happy ever after dream. The narrative devices that are used in literature for girls, and I'm going to look particularly at girls' comics, are in many ways like those of romantic novels, and I want to argue that they operate in similar ways to prepare girls for what's to come. And so they're a very powerful medium indeed, which can't be countered by a simple realism or an anti-sexist approach to children's literature of the kind that's actually at least very popular in Britain at the moment. And I'm going to talk a bit about that. Specifically, these narratives, as we'll see when I show you some examples on the overhead projector, are quite fantastic, and they move beyond realism and operate, I want to argue, on desire and at the level of fantasy, and it's that which is very important. Now, before I go any further, I think I should explain that I discovered for the first time on arrival in the States that the particular kind of literature I'm going to talk about, that's weekly comics for prepubescent girls in Britain, don't actually exist here. And that's interesting in itself. These are comics which are produced and sell massive sales, particularly to working class young girls. They come out every week, and they contain strip stories, cartoon-like strip stories in serial form for the most part. I'm going to show you some examples of those, and apparently nothing like that exists here, so it's interesting to actually look at the differences in the forms that are available on both sides of the Atlantic. Okay, well, let me begin by talking about some existing approaches to sexism in children's literature, because I think it was important that a lot of feminist work in the 1960s and 70s crucially examined children's literature in relation to sexism. But what it did was suggest that there were stereotyped images which often presented traditional sex roles and a traditional sexual division of labour. And what they suggested was that this could be resolved by presenting alternative images to, and I quote from one such example, extend children's thinking beyond stereotyping, both through in-depth discussion and by providing a range of material, stories, pictures, films, people, which presents a broader image of what girls, boys, men and women are really like. Okay, so here you present, you counter these bad images with politically desirable ones, and so you assume that what girls are really like exists somehow in a simple sense outside the children's literature. And that these texts themselves simply bias or distort that reality. They don't present it like it is. and that it can be countered by presenting it in another way. Now, one of the problems with that for me is that I want to suggest that the cultural products, like these comics themselves, actually create positions for girls to enter into them, and so they have what we might call regimes of meaning in them, and that create fictional identities in the stories themselves, not in a kind of role way that are simply taken on board, but they're taken on board and related to in a much deeper sense. They form multiple and often contradictory places where femininity itself is both produced, resolved, and where contradictions and conflicts are worked through. And it's that idea about contradictions and conflicts that I want to dwell on. I want to argue that the production of fictions and fantasy are very important in relation to the development of feminine sexuality, and particularly to relate to that issues about power and desire. Stereotyping approaches often assume that a shift in information is what's needed, that when little girls see alternative images, they too will want to be something different. They'll want to engage in those things by which, by virtue of their gender, they've been forbidden. But this issue of wanting, I suggest, is much more complex than the idea of alternative images suggests, and I want to relate it to fantasy and desire, and particularly the ways in which fantasy helps us to engage with and resolve conscious and unconscious conflicts. Now, certainly there's an issue here of the problem of how we read the kinds of narrative devices in these comics and the issues of interpretation, which I know Janice is going to talk about. And much psychoanalytic work in relation to fiction for women and girls has tended to follow the path of suggesting that there's only one reading, and that it doesn't really look at the position of the interpreter or theorist who's putting their own interpretation on the fiction itself. But I want to look at that in several ways, and I'm going to look both at the fiction for girls and the fiction of girls, that is, the fiction of childhood and femininity that's constructed both in these narratives and in other places like the schoolroom. And I want to mention several things. Firstly, a kind of voyeurism of a social scientist or psychologist or teacher or theorist who claims to know the truth about children and girls, who therefore doesn't engage with the important aspects of desire in our own knowing, of wanting to explain what we see, and the fictions which this knowing, for example, psychological knowing, the truth about children's development, for example, actually produces its own fiction and invests that as a true account of girls' sexuality and development. And then, thirdly, to look at how girls and women themselves struggle in relation to those identities created in these fictional spaces. Now, I want to use the word struggle advisedly, because I'm not talking about a passive engagement, the taking on of a role model, but actually something that's struggled over in relation to both in the texts and in other spaces in the social world. So I'm not arguing for a pre-given femininity, which fiction helps or hinders, but fiction is actually a central component of our everyday lives. So not just in stories, but actually in all the practices that make up our social world. So central to the idea of struggle, for me, is the issue of power. And part of that is the concern about power and powerlessness and its relation to independence and dependence. Now, I'm not going to argue again that women are dependent, but I will suggest that the result of their struggles often particularly render certain girls or position them in certain ways which lead to their insertion in various kinds of double bind, particularly the double bind of a kind of infantilization within patriarchal practices in which their only source of power is through servicing, caring, through the caring and the caring professions, or service and the service industries. Now, moving on to fiction itself, I want to suggest that these young girls as readers make meaning through the production of fantasy relations in the texts themselves. And while they all are themselves already created with these other within these other fictional spaces, within these other practices, and so that reading isn't a simple passive thing, but a dynamic act in which the fictional places which have already created their identities also engage with the fictions that they're reading. I want to look at several different fictional sites or practices for where girls' identity is related. Is created, especially those which relate to heterosexuality. I know that Janice talks a lot in her work about the way that women read romance novels to escape the drudgery of their lives, in which they have to become part of caring in the caring professions or service in the service industries, how they're looking after other people. And there was a very nice quote that I liked in one of Janice's papers where she talks about this woman who says, all the time that she takes the children to the dentists and she takes them to the doctors and she does this and she does that, and reading the novels is actually her own private space away from all that. And it's that aspect of privacy which I think is also very important. They provide moments of escape into a fictional space in which wishes can come true. The heroine is recognised, desired, and wins the prize, the man, the home, the family. Now, in these novels, women win a man, and that yet turns out not to be the resolution of the dream that they'd hoped for. Here they are taking all the kids to the dentist all the time, and what they longed for was something else, and the only space in which that's possible is in the romantic novels, or that's how I read what you were saying, Janice. They can only imagine a different order in which their dreams will come true, in which they'll be happy ever after. And in these novels, they focus on the right man, the one who will love them as they desire to be loved. Now, in that sense, these novels form part of their coping strategy for dealing with their everyday lives, in which they feel they get nothing for themselves. And then here is certainly a distinction between fantasy engagement in the text and what happens in the rest of their lives. But I want to make that distinction not as fantasy and reality, but as fantasy as something which is, or something which is lived in lived in the head and therefore related to delusional states away from the real. But fantasy is creating important fictions which position women in the real every day. So the fiction of the mother is just as much a fiction as the caring, servicing, nurturant mother, as is the dream come true of heterosexual romance. So how then do girls and women come to occupy these positions? And how do they struggle to occupy and to cope with them and to resist and avoid them? In this sense, reading romance novels and popular literature for girls can be seen as a kind of resistance to the position of service and carer, but one which is contradictory, since at the same time it helps to get them there. Relatedly then, we can see little girls as engaged in a struggle to be something and to resist something, what the current social order demands of them. I want then to examine some of the concomitants of just such struggles. And I want first to look at an example of the way in which girls are put in a double bind, in which they both struggle for power and end up in positions in which they have to reproduce the dependency in others. And particularly the positions for girls, which I've looked at in some of my work on young girls and schooling, is that girls can either be in the position of the mother, that is dependable, or they can be in the position of what Juliet Mitchell calls the hysteric, that is they can deny that they can't possess the phallus, in Lacan's terms, and that those are the only two positions open to them. And I just want to give you a couple of examples of girls playing in a nursery to show you the relationship between those kinds of fantasies that are engaged in every day and the reading that girls do. One is a little girl who is playing doctors and nurses in the nursery, and in fact the teacher has set up this game, and of course she's given all the white coats to the boys and all the nurses' uniforms to the girls. But one of the girls actually tries very hard to subvert this, having been asked to help the doctors. She actually goes into the home corner of the nursery and she starts making cups of tea, and then she turns it into making supper. One of the doctors arrives in the home corner and she says to him, "You've got to go quickly." And he says, "Why?" He says, "Because you're going to work." And then he says, rather reluctantly, "But I'm being a doctor." And she says, "Well, you've got to go to work, doctor, because you've got to go to the hospital, and so do I." "You don't like cabbage, do you?" And he shakes his head. "Well, you haven't got cabbage then. I'm going to hospital. If you tidy up this room, make sure and tell me." Okay, so in this tiny little moment, she actually shifts the power relations in the only way that she can, which is to stop being the subservient nurse and to actually be the controlling housewife stroke mother who actually gives the doctor his dinner and sends him off to work, in which he's infantilized in it. Now, in many of the games I looked at in the nursery, that struggle was played out again and again and again. Girls strove to create domestic play in which they had power as mothers. Boys equally strove to disrupt domestic play because they tended always to be infantilized by the girls as their little boys and told what to do, precisely because it was a site of power for the girls. The boys would want to shift it, and they did so in often very, very nasty ways. And so here are the girls then, not passive and dependent in any simple sense, but actually struggling and always put in that kind of double bind in which the sites, the fictional spaces in which they can have power are also themselves full of conflict and contradictory. Okay, so how then do literature for girls also provide places in which that struggle can be engaged with? What's being struggled with and what's being struggled against? Now, the particular girls' comics that I've had a look at are two ones called Bunty and Tracy, which are for prepubescent girls in England, and as I said, they contain strip stories. And I want to, well,
I'll unplug this.
Organisation of these different comics. I mean, one of the things that happens again and again is that the stories present miserable circumstances, often very difficult lives, but they do so in a way that provides solutions and escapes, ways out in fantasy and in practice. The stories often romanticise poverty and suggest a way of dealing with it which is almost masochistic. It's desirable because it can be suffered virtuously and moved beyond. And poverty is presented as a result of tragic circumstances in which children are often orphaned, and so there are families who are wicked and oppressive, which are usually the result of some terrible accident of fate. And so these stories, I think, are palatable precisely because they are fantastic at one level. They're actually removed from everyday life in a variety of ways. A different historical period, a different geographic location, the overwhelming use of surrogate parents and siblings. Most of the stories are not about children who are with their biological parents or their siblings. So in that sense, they're not a realist text in any simple sense. And here are, in the the comics that I looked at, the topics that they cover. Apart from 11 strip stories who are about girls who do not have or don't live with their parents, the other 7 are about the following. A girl who's helpful and does good and kindly deeds for others, except when she puts on a glove puppet, at which point her character completely changes and she becomes vicious, angry and evil. And of course, the moment she takes off the glove puppet, she has no recollection of her evil deeds. A girl who's perfect at school, clever, beautiful, helpful, sensible, but whose cleverness and good deeds make her the object of envy, and therefore she becomes very unpopular and unhappy. A girl who lives with her mother, the latter having been made redundant, and the girl is saved from having to sell a precious camera by her ingenuity in using it to make money by selling photographs, and she uses her camera for kindly deeds for others. A girl whose mother is a teacher who's chosen to live in a rough, teach in a rough comprehensive school and is constantly trying to reform the children. And her daughter, by her own ingenuity and good deeds, actually has to take responsibility for the innocence of the mother. A girl who was a Victorian serving girl who's been frozen for 100 years in a block of ice. A girl gymnast from an Eastern Bloc country who's helped to escape by a British girl gymnast. A horse who develops a theme of jealousy, and another horse who's jealous of her, but the heroine's horse helps the other unselfishly despite the other's jealousy. Okay? So those are the stories, apart from the ones which are centre on orphaned girls who are in receipt of gross injustice. For example, when orphan Joni Jackson was adopted by Kate and Robert Stewart, she looked forward to the kind of happy family she'd always dreamed of, but things didn't quite work out as she planned. Okay, so here then are themes of both escape from very difficult circumstances, escape from terrible families into a resolution with the longed-for, wealthy, happy family, or fantasies of helpfulness in which the rewards are given precisely by the girl's suppression of her own desires in order to produce those of others. And so deprivation and loss are countered by girls' active struggle to bring about the resolution of the bourgeois dream, the wealthy and happy mother and father. Now, I'm suggesting that this actually prefigures in some important ways the arrival of the man in romantic novels, even though there's nothing overtly heterosexual about them. Now, in a previous analysis that I did, I concentrated very much on the loss, what girls had lost, and how this helped to produce these girls as passive victims of harsh circumstances. That their very passivity seemed to get them what they desired. But also, although I said that I think that what's important is the loss, and that it's presented as inevitable, and yet it can be made good by certain actions on the part of the girl, selflessness, helpfulness, caring for others, cleverness for others, so she can buy those qualities which she displays, that is precisely the qualities of traditional feminine caring, win the fantasy of escape, the prizes and the man. Now what's important here then is the way in which the comics work on those losses and those lacks themselves. What the girl has lost and what she can gain and how she can do it. Her own active part in that struggle to resolve certain conflicts. Now, Freud suggested, for example, that it was very common for young children to fantasise about alternative families of better birth, and that enabled them to work through very difficult conflicts within their family by distancing them from them, so that cruel parents could become not one's real parents, and therefore they could be replaced by the fantasised good parents. Now these comics, therefore, work at a level of fantasy in inscribing girls in those fantasies which are not served by realism, but may be explicitly explicitly aided by this kind of romanticism, and I wanted to suggest that particularly harsh and difficult circumstances are romanticised in these stories. However, what's important is what are the circumstances, how they're resolved, and what the end is. So there are conflicts which are set up to engage with ones already present for girls, and that's what I'm suggesting about entering into the fantasy. That here are girls already engaging in the practices of their everyday lives with conflicts which they have to deal with, and that the fantasy devices of the comics allow further engagement. But more than that, because they present certain ways of resolving these conflicts and therefore certain solutions, they're very powerful devices indeed, which are nothing like the realism of the alternative images for girls of the realist anti-sexist text. So they inscribe the reader in a fantasy scenario which provides a way for her to actively engineer a resolution. And so you get, as you saw in those two that I put up, there's jealousy, rivalry, harsh relatives, but they're also dealt with in particular ways. The jealousy and the rivalry is often split between characters, as in the She'll Stay a Slave. There's a bad girl and a good girl. The jealousy is always projected out onto the bad character. And there are no, for example, there are no rivalries, sibling rivalries with boys. The relationships between brothers, for example, are never dealt with. So if you look at them, there are a whole set of conflicts for girls which are dealt with, and a whole set of others which remain precisely silent in the text. And that's also very important in relation to later literature for girls, as I'll say in a minute. Okay, so the drudgery of women's lives and girls' lives and the poverty of being working class, particularly for these young readers, can be escaped from by providing these resolutions, and providing they do it in the right way. So therefore here doesn't mean a resistance which is active. Anger, complaint or jealousy, all of those are in the bad characters, but an attempt to struggle to be a good girl, and that being a good girl will bring about its own rewards, as we've seen. So it's a docile subject, and a docile worker, and a docile mother, all of which will be resolved through the struggle of fantasy's escape into wealthy life. So it's a very, very specific fantasy. Well, what is lost and what is gained? Certainly living out of a fantasy relates to, in certain important ways, in psychoanalytic terms, the loss of the mother and the Oedipal investment in the father. But how are girls to live this out? Can they only either become the hysterical the mother? Are they infantilised, or can they have a career? Now, one of the things that I was quite critical of when I did this work was some psychoanalytic work within feminism which suggested that the loss for girls and women is, to quote Louise Eichenbaum and Susie Orbach, buried and denied in the culture at large. Now, I want to suggest that it's certainly not buried and denied at all. It's quite there, present in fictions like these. What's important is not its burying and denial, but precisely how it's worked with, and therefore what fantasies are put forward for dealing with that loss and its resolution. So failure, then, in that sense, is quite inevitable. It's not like the imposition of roles, that these girls will always fail to achieve something, but what's important is the struggle for it. So why are these comics, then, so effective and successful? They operate at the level of fantasy to engage with the loss and its fulfilment. Therefore, they invite particular solutions and particular identities. And so, in many ways, they prepare girls for the romantic resolution, and, I argue, prepare girls for the adolescent magazines that they'll come onto later. Now, in Britain also, there are magazines for slightly older girls, some of which have been examined by Angela McRobbie in her work on Jackie, which is a magazine for teenage girls, or slightly older than the girls that read these stories. And they are romantic stories in which girls actually do gain the boy. And they also operate in certain kinds of important ways. The girls in the Jackie stories operate with a fatalism about loss, especially the loss of the boy. They're encouraged to wait for better luck next time, and the struggle, therefore, that they engage with is the attraction of the next boy rather than examining the aspects of anything that's gone before. And since this attracting of the next boy could happen anywhere from the bus stop to the disco, the girl has to be always prepared and therefore always engaging and struggling. And yet, in the same way that Janice is saying that romantic novels are read in privacy, Angela McRobbie also suggested that these kinds of magazines, like other aspects of subculture for girls, are engaged in private, are often read in private, and subculture for girls is engaged in the privacy, very often, of the girls' bedrooms. Very, very unlike, of course, the subcultural spaces for boys.
As a result of the reading this sample of good books and bad books that I was reading recommended by these women, and it posed an interesting kind of suggestion. This was in the sample of bad books, but it wasn't considered the worst by the women I talked to. It was right on the borderline. They liked it, but disliked it for a particular reason. And it was an interesting plot because he had two heroines, a good girl and a bad girl. Now, I think that could be altered. But what was interesting about the good girl story was that she developed a professional identity both before she became involved with a male, and in some ways as a consequence to the way she was constructed passively in a power relationship with a professor. She then gets herself out of that original relationship with the professor, develops individually in a career, and then stumbles into an ideal relationship as it's constructed by my romance readers. And the story eventually resolves itself, and the book ends with her in her apartment in New York, and the hero in Abu Dhabi or someplace. And she's thinking about this ideal relationship, and she's thinking, well, I have my work, and there will always be Peter. And then she thinks to herself at the end of the story, well, maybe there won't always be Peter, but it exists for now. And the last line of the book is, and she got down to work. So there's a kind of open-endedness about the story, a kind of temporariness about the relationship. Now, what was fascinating with respect to the women is they liked her as a heroine because they could identify with her strength and her power. But what they found disturbing about the book was the ambiguity of the ending. Okay? So every time I end up coming close to imagining something on the order of what you're talking about, it wouldn't speak to romance readers. So then you get involved in the whole issue of political gradualism and what does it mean to gradually convert romance readers. I have no idea whether that's possible, but it's worth trying, I think. Yeah.
What is the functional
I think that it's a hard to answer it with a simple kind of answer. I think that there are multiple things going on in the way a trained individual who has been privileged to be part of high culture reads that material, so that when anyone would pick up, say now, Jane Eyre, I think there are multiple things going on. One is that it's canonical, or at least alternately canonical, and there's a question of status that's involved in reading. But at the same time, I do think that they address many of the same conflicts and address the construction of desire in some ways. I haven't come to any final conclusion about the way value is connected with complexity. My argument, I guess, would be that Jane Eyre or the Brontes or whatever constructs those conflicts in a more complicated way and resolves them less perfectly, so that there's still an open-ended nature to the resolution, whereas I would say that there is not in the average category romance. Yeah.
It's not anything I've particularly done any work on, because we do have soap operas too. Yeah. But are there soap operas here specifically for children?
No.
It's hard for me to answer because I don't know the comics real well. But on the basis of having read the paper, and there might be similarities in the way teenage girls engage with soap operas, particularly since soap operas have been changed recently, where the characters in the soap operas are much younger, and soaps have been transformed in a kind of consideration of romance,
mm-hmm.
Much more so than previously. So you've got a really good idea. I think you might be quite right.
One thing to ask about your comics, are the same characters, it's like week to week, you follow this character week to week?
Yes. The stories last so many weeks, and there are several stories in a comic.
Okay, well, one of the things that interests me is the idea of a form that continues on,
yes, as opposed
to the closure that you have in the romance.
Yes, we were talking about that earlier. It's actually not something I've explored particularly,
yeah,
but I think it's very important. Yeah.
Well, and the group that I talk to, I have no idea how extensive this is in the romance audience generally, but in the group that I talk to, they were not soap watchers at all. And there were two reasons that they didn't watch soaps. They were offended by the morality of the soaps. They thought that they explored perversions and that sort of thing. But the other thing was they didn't like the fact that it didn't end. They wanted to see that story end, and they had elaborate procedures,
mm-hmm,
to select books on any given occasion so that you could read it in one sitting and get to the resolution.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
Well,
the suggestion that there's this radically different population in the romances and the soaps, and I would have thought they would have been.
I would have thought so too. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it may have to do with the question of resolution and the way in which the romance audience wants to see the family romance resolve, and perhaps a soap audience, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, a soap audience is obviously tolerating an ongoingness. Soaps may be a way of coping more realistically with day-to-day life, in the sense that soaps are in some ways close to the notion of suffering, close to the way notion of coping, and not so removed fantastically. But I'm thinking off the top of my head. I really don't know.
I think it has to do with community more. I think that the soaps have more to do every day, and they go on. It's a sense of community that you have there.
Yeah.
A friend of my mother's was just going, oh my God, and then you did this, and I thought it was like this horrible story about people that she,
yeah,
knew. But it was that she was so involved with the community,
yeah,
there that she didn't feel otherwise.
That's possible. The other thing is that I found with these romance readers is they're involved with the community of romance writers. And they feel connected to these women. They know all about these women. They know their personal lives. And they're deeply involved with these people. So that it's almost not a world of books as much as it is a world of readers and writers. So, yeah, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I wonder if you think there's any kind of essence of subjectivity in knowing the kind of formulaic quality of these books and of these and of the comic strips. That there's an element and a possible subjectivity of subversion in the very fact that these women who choose these have a real knowledge of what they're going to get in a way, and choose it as an act of subjectivity, and that there can be a possible subversion in that.
The fact that they know
about the repetition, they know,
yeah,
about the formula. It's not. I mean, rather near the friend, people talks about the repetition being always denigrated, but there could be a possible subversion in knowing that you're doing something that is going to be formulaic, and that you're engaging in that formulaic process with the knowledge of that, with your own technique.
it's an interesting idea. I tried to explore the issue this way. In addition, they talk about the books, the women, as if they were novels. When I asked questions like, describe a typical romantic heroine to me, they'd look utterly nonplussed and say, well, there's not a typical romantic heroine. And I'd say, well, describe a typical romantic plot. And they would say, well, there isn't a typical romantic plot. So that in many ways, the stories were constructed as novels. And when they discussed them, they could indeed remember plots, and they could remember characteristics of individual characters. So that in that some way, that proved to me that they did engage with them as unique stories of unique individuals. On the other hand, they did exhibit, unconsciously, very rigid notions of what a basic core plot structure is like. And I found, to my surprise, that about two-thirds of the group at least occasionally had to read the ending of the story before they took it out of the store. So I argue that they wanted to make sure that it had that ending. So what I argue is that there's a tension between the need to believe that women lead original lives and the desire to see the patriarchal structure develop. So what you have is the illusion that this is a new story about a new woman leading a new life. But in fact, what it shows you is that the myth that women are defined by and through others is restored. So that's sort of the way I tried to deal with it. Your construction is very interesting, though. Yeah.
Maybe the romance
novels have been translated into
female
series, and I wonder if they have. I tried to find out through the publishing industry what percentage of romance novels are written by men, and from everybody I got the statement that it isn't many. I don't know what that means. But the women insisted that they could tell the difference between a male-authored romance and a female-authored romance. And I was skeptical. I thought, oh, they couldn't be right. But I accepted what they said. And when I set out the two samples of ideal books and failed books, I started to read the failed books. And I got through one, and I got to the sex scene, and I thought, point of view has shifted. And so I looked, and indeed, it had been written by a man. And it happened twice in this sample. And I really am not nearly as educated a romance reader as the women were. But each time you got to a sex scene, the point of view would shift and it would become a male fantasy of a woman offering herself. And so I could detect it. I think the women can detect it. They did say that there are a few men that they like, but not many.
So in the public libraries here, there are sweet dream novels. Young, like, pre-adolescents, children, even more about 9, 10, 11, 12, and the Harlequins and everything else, they walk over to the adult area to pick up those. They don't continue, but the covers of the books have almost identical girls on them. They're all in a different pose or whatever, the classic Barbie doll kind of girl, and the right kind of clothes, and each girl's a little bit different, so the kids pretty much know which story it is by the cover. And they do come up to me and they ask about the office. We have almost no information on those offers, so there's no engagement there. But I've tried to read those, and the plots in those are, to me, are very similar. And I've always tried to find something else that I can offer. Whenever they say they want ones that are spicier, I think the adult area. But if I'm trying to find a children's book that would have a positive, just something different from the girl gets the boy in the end, and she's done something to herself to get it. She's either stopped being so aggressive, or she's dressed in a Michelin suit. And I'm always trying to find something else. I really can't. It's enough. But maybe a dozen that I could think of. And that's very, very limited for all the books that are there, all those series that are available.
And they're called Sweet Dreams.
Sweet Dreams, Wishing Star. I'm just interested in what you say about the authors and the interest in the romance audience and others. Can you discuss the nature of that interest, and is there a possibility of a ledge there either from the point of view of getting to the authors or from the point of view of having the romance readers speculate, because it's one measure closer to their reality. They can't sound quite the same degree. Speculate about
Right. That, I think, is another wedge or seam. That they're fascinated with the women because they are capable and creative. The women that I talk to divide the world into book readers and non-book readers. And people engaged with books tend to be, in their view, intelligent, sensible, not given to mindless kind of play. And they, that kind of bleeds over into their notion of creativity with respect to writing. They want to know as much as they can about the woman's personal life, because they want to believe, I think, that she has the kind of ideal relationship that she writes about. They know, in fact, that many of the women had very painful childhoods. I don't know, again, how much that could be borne out in a statistical sample, but it seemed to me that many of the women they were talking to me about had very unhappy childhoods. There is, apparently, a very high conversion rate for women who are readers to become writers. If you think about it, it would have to be true, because right now 40% of all mass market paperbacks are romances. It means that something like 100 romances are published every month. Obviously, there have to be thousands, hundreds of thousands of women out there attempting to write romances so that these publishing houses can issue this many things. Now, if that's true, if one of the things that romance reading can lead to is romance writing, then what you've seen is a very important shift. A woman who has been silent has suddenly adopted a public voice of a sort, bought a typewriter, and declared a space within which she has to work. And what's interesting is there's great conflict within the family when this occurs. A student I know of at Penn just finished a dissertation at the Annenberg School of Communications, and she did interviews with 60-some romance writers through the Romance Writers of America chapter in Philadelphia. And what was fascinating about that is that many of those women described themselves as feminists and described themselves as angry with publishers because they couldn't vary the genre the way they wanted. So I think that, again, can be explored. I think that there is a possibility of working with some romance writers and of varying the genre in ways that would at least make it not so monolithic. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to formulate this question, but I'm wondering about the relationship between ways of reading and changing the social order. I mean, in certain ways, it's clear that you could sort of change the romance plot to the feminist plot, and that if you don't change the social order, and that you just read for what now becomes the new normative happy ending, that there's no change at all.
Right.
And I was wondering what each of you thought about, I don't know, what reading has, how we change the way we read to make it a more subversive act, or even how the way we teach reading to make it a more subversive act.
That's a good question. Why did you start?
It's obviously the crucial question. I don't have answers that are satisfactory to me at all. I don't believe that it's sufficient to transform either the act of reading or the way in which reading practices are extended to the rest of the world. Clearly, the material and social situation has to be changed as well. But the reason I think that reading has to be engaged with and mass-produced fantasies have to be engaged with is that I think the site of cultural production has to be a site for political action as well. But it has to be shored up with all kinds of practices. Now, to pose the question of how to teach reading, that's creative. I actually hadn't thought about that before. Except insofar as the way I teach reading in a classroom with college students, which would be a way of critically engaging with the text instead of simply absorbing the text. Again, I'm just... Valerie, do you have an answer?
Well, not really, no. I can only think of two ways to address what you're saying, and neither of them address it properly, but I suppose one of the things that has occurred to me lately is that as well as kind of teaching reading or engaging with how we read, we also have to engage with our own positioning in relation to this. As theorists, for example, or as feminists, that, I mean, one of the things that's been important for me lately is trying to link, as I said in the talk, the fictions in the narrative, the fictional narratives, to other fictions of the child, and how therefore social scientists and theorists become involved in producing those fictions. Now, in order to understand that, we have to engage with ourselves. That is our own desires to know. And it seems to me that there are two things there. One might be, if we took that psychoanalytically in Lacan's terms, one would be romance reading would be about an imaginary closure, a wish fulfillment. But our own engagement would be a fictional fantasy of symbolic control. And it's just as much a fiction and a fantasy space, and I think we need to engage with that ourselves, and therefore our desires to be that and to know that and to explain and to understand. And I think in my own work and teaching, that's what I try to do, so that we don't separate ourselves from these other set of people who, as it were, read differently. So that we position them as other, and then leave ourselves outside in this voyeuristic way of kind of looking in. Now, that doesn't answer your question, but it's the only way I can think of to engage with it. In terms of teaching reading, there is actually an important issue in relation to teaching reading and children's learning to read, because certainly very little work for children learning to read engages with these issues about fiction and fantasy at all. And the most, in quotes, progressive approaches to the teaching of reading use a rather, a very staid form of kind of using linguistics to make sense. But there is no insertion of a reader in a set of practices of reading. Neither is there any fantasy engagement or investment in the reading. So none of that actually goes on. So reading in that sense is only at best in those approaches seen as a linguistic process, not as a social practice. And therefore there aren't different kinds of reading. At least that's as far as work with little children is concerned.
Can I ask a question about the question of giving up the fantasy of symbolic control? Is it possible to give up that desire, or at least engage that desire to control, and remain politically committed in the same space?
Why not?
Well, I guess what I was thinking is that if you're engaging with people with whom you don't politically agree, to retain your political commitment is in some ways always to say that you know better.
Yeah.
So that in some ways you're still retaining control, no matter how athletic you are at pretending not to be. That's the dilemma for me. I don't know any way out of it.
To engage in power, to change power.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Yes, I mean, I suppose I was just trying to stand back and say, well, what are the desires inscribed in those kinds of productions, those kinds of work, and if we understand those, and particularly in relation to the skewing of masculinity and femininity that you're talking about, whereas femininity is inscribed in the helping to know, and masculinity is inscribed in the knowing, you know, I mean, then we could begin to look at those kinds of differences and look at it in a different way. That's as far as I can manage, really.
That's helpful.
I'm just wondering about your audience for romance readers as opposed to... I'm just wondering about the audience for romance readers as opposed to soap operas, because one thing that I've noticed with soap operas is that it puts romance in a very public domain, that a large part of soap operas is not only watching the soap opera, but watching it and discussing it outside of actually seeing it. And you have said that a lot of women consider reading romance as a very private thing, but I was wondering if there was the same kind of discussion among romance readers.
There,
also, whether men read romance, because there are a fair number of men who watch.
Yeah. All right. So the first part of your question, there does seem to be a certain amount of community. Although in the group that I talked to, the women did not have extended networks with whom they discussed romances. Generally, women seem to have one other woman to discuss romances with: a mother, a sister, an aunt, or a neighbor. They don't seem to be extended networks. Now, this may be a function of the fact that these were middle-class suburban housewives who were isolated in homes. They're also wealthy enough to buy their books. There are lending library networks and there are loaning networks at work. So that kind of thing is going on. And I think that obviously needs to be explored. The question of male readership is again very difficult to assess. It's not possible, at least so far, to get any statistics from the romance publishers. They're absolutely paranoid, and if you go in, because there's a lot of money involved in the business. So when I went, they didn't believe that I was an academic. They thought I was a spy. So it's not possible to get the kind of statistics. From everything they told me, that audience is very small. There is a male audience, but it's small. But I have no idea whether that's 2%, 10%, what.
Did you choose to work with a group that was wives and mothers before you began research, or did you?
It was really out of desperation. I was just trying to deal with the whole question of readership and thinking about ways, how do you get at readership? And I hoped to be able to do it randomly, but there wasn't enough known about the romance audience that I could construct that kind of sample. I hoped to do it through letters to editors, but they're not kept. So what happened was somebody sent me a Xerox of an article about this woman out in the Midwest who was a clerk in a bookstore who had amassed this loyal following. So it is not a scientifically designed sample. It's pre-selected. But the reason I wanted to do it is I felt that what had been worked out in this group was some kind of implicit aesthetic. And what I was trying to get at was the way in which an aesthetic is situated culturally and socially. And I figured that this group would be useful for that. So it's really nothing more than a case study that must be duplicated in many different ways before we can see the way in which the audience varies.
Just wanted to ask, with the privatization of romance reading, is there associated with that any sense of stigmatization?
With romance reading? Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the most difficult things to overcome was the absolute fear of being scorned. The romance women are deeply wounded by the way the culture deals with what they think is so valuable to them. And they're very wary of the way their husbands treat their romance reading, the way their kids treat romance reading, the way newspaper reporters and the way women's livers treat them. They're very, very aware of that. And so they often have brown paper covers to cover the books if they go to a doctor's office or if they're riding on a bus or something. It's something that has to be privatized because of its scorn, because of the scorn. It's very hard for them to deal with. Yeah, we probably should end because I think everybody wants to go to lunch. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.